Today on Maine Calling, the latest from Augusta and an editor's roundtable on this month's headlines. The Mills administration is bracing for a possible breach of the national debt limit as negotiations continue in Washington. A default could delay benefit payments for Social Security recipients and paychecks for the roughly 10,000 federal employees in Maine. And state officials also warned that they might have to tap budget reserves to fill the funding gap. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program, we'll check in with our Political Pulse team for the latest on this developing story and on other key issues before state lawmakers as the session enters its final stages. And we'll hear from our roundtable of Maine newspaper editors on the stories that made headlines this month, from the effort to expand abortion protections in Maine to the surprise arrival of asylum seekers in Sanford. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at WelchForbes.com. By Maine Seacoast Mission, strengthening Maine's coastal and island communities through education, health, and support. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn.
I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. As negotiators in Washington close in on a deal to resolve the looming debt ceiling crisis, the Mills administration is bracing itself for the possible consequences of a breach. Today on the show, we'll talk about that story and some of the other top stories that have made the headlines this past month with our Political Pulse team and later our roundtable of editorial page editors. And of course, as always, we want to hear from you. But first, we turn to Steve Missler, Maine Public Chief Political Correspondent, and this week, in for Kevin Miller, Maine Public Reporter Patty White. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
Steve, let's just start with the elephant in the room, as we've all been watching closely, even in the past few minutes. It appears the White House and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy are nearing a two-year deal on raising the debt ceiling. But as we hold our breath, the Mills administration says it's preparing for the possibility that the U.S. government might default, which it said would have says would have serious implications for the state economy and for Maine residents. What are they worried about?
Yeah, the slow-moving drama, Keith, of allowing the federal government to pay its bills is inching closer to a self-inflicted disaster if these negotiations don't pan out that you just mentioned. And that's left states and governors to game out exactly what will happen if Republicans in the U.S. House don't reach a deal with the Biden administration and decline to raise the debt limit by June 1st, which is the default date. The reason this affects state government is because states receive a lot of federal funding to administer all kinds of programs, from dairy inspections to Medicaid, which is a health insurance program for low-income people. And we also have something like 10,000 federal employees that work here in Maine. If the federal government defaults, basically what happens is that it has to decide which of its debts it will actually pay. And since this has never happened before, it's led to all sorts of speculation that federal programs will go unfunded, people on Social Security won't get their paychecks, and people on Medicaid or Medicare might not get coverage. Again, some of this is very speculative, but the Mills administration has done an analysis of possible scenarios, and their big takeaway is that Maine might be able to cover some of the costs in the programs that it co-funds with the feds because it has a significant budget surplus, but only for a little while. Basically, the longer this drags on, the worse it will be for Maine residents. And Governor Janet Mills described it as potentially catastrophic for Maine, with effects that could ripple through the state economy, in effect, unemployment rates and personal income.
So there's a little bit of a buffer fund there, but it would run out if this isn't resolved in a certain amount of time. The default would also affect the two-year budget also, which has already been approved, right? So what would happen there?
Right. So potentially it could affect the state budget, because when the budget was signed into law, what it does is it takes a significant part of it is based on revenue projections and forecasted tax collections like income and corporate taxes. Well, if personal income falls and unemployment skyrockets and tax collections plummet, that would mean Maine could be looking at a precarious budget situation that the legislature would need to address by way of spending cuts. Maine law requires a balanced budget. So if the state suddenly sees a big dip in revenue that blows a hole in the current spending plan, the governor and the legislature will have to step in and make some pretty tough decisions.
The legislature, meanwhile, continues to slog through its work with a lot of big ticket proposals still awaiting action by the House and Senate. Among them, the governor's bill allowing abortions later in pregnancy, which has yet to emerge from judiciary, as I understand it. Patty, remind us of what this bill would do and what its chances are.
Well, it would do a few things. So current Maine law allows abortions until viability, which is generally considered around 24 weeks. And after that, abortions are only allowed if the health or the life of the mother is in danger. This bill would remove that standard and allow abortions after viability if a medical provider decides it's necessary. So the idea is to let medical providers with their patients decide. It was inspired by Dana Pierce's story. She's a Maine mom who found out when she was 32 weeks pregnant that her baby had a severe lethal fetal abnormality. She felt the baby was suffering. She wanted to get an abortion. She couldn't get it in Maine. She had to go to Colorado and spend tens of thousands of dollars. So on top of this very traumatic diagnosis, she had a very traumatic experience. And the idea is to help people in similar situations get abortions later in pregnancy. It's also a decriminalization bill. So it would protect providers from criminal penalties for performing abortions later in pregnancy, and it would also protect people who help others get a medication abortion in Maine. And finally, it would change the way that data is collected to better protect the identity of people who get abortions. And as for its chances, I mean, you know, it's Governor Mills' bill. She's a Democrat. It's a democratically controlled legislature. I think it's worth pointing out that even though Roe v. Wade was overturned almost a year ago, this is the first chance that Maine lawmakers have to vote on this issue. And I think supporters think that's going to work in their favor. I also think there's a desire among some in Maine to for the state to really take a strong stance on this issue, given that other states are enacting restrictions. They want Maine to be a place that counters those restrictions.
Right.
So
this obviously has opposition, and those opponents are saying that they would do a people's veto if this passed, Steve. Although do they still believe they can defeat it in the legislature?
Yeah, Keith, the people's veto is a consideration, at least according to the Christian Civic League of Maine. The league has been really organizing a lot of the opposition at the state house, and Director Carol Conley told me recently that his focus is first on defeating the bill in the legislature. Now, as Patty pointed out, that might be difficult based on the number of co-sponsors that the bill has. It's over 90, and the fact that Democrats have such solid majorities to pass this thing. But there are a few holdouts, and I think the Christian Civic League will focus on persuading them to oppose the bill. I don't have a great sense of how successful they've been on that in that regard. I think the few Democrats that have that are wavering on this or reluctant, they're really kind of keeping their views close to themselves at the moment. But if the league is not successful and the bill becomes law, then I think you'll see a movement to launch a people's veto to overturn it. Connolly told me it's something they're contemplating, but he didn't want to get too far ahead and guarantee it. That said, the league might be one of several groups that contemplate such a thing. There's been a lot of rumors and speculation about other groups, just Republican-led groups that might spearhead this. But if there is to be a people's veto, I think the Christian Civic League will be a big player, just because they have the ability to organize a lot of like-minded churches. And that's why that was evident actually during the public hearing, when a record number of people showed up to testify, and most of them were abortion opponents.
Opponents held a rally this week that coincided with a public hearing on a paid family leave proposal that's being pushed by Democrats and progressive advocacy groups, but is opposed by business groups. Supporters point out, Patty, that Maine is the only state in New England that doesn't have such a paid family leave law. So how does this work?
How does the paid leave program work?
Yeah.
I mean, so it would allow workers to take up to 12 weeks off each year. It would be paid for through a payroll contribution that would be split evenly between employers and employee. It would be capped at 1%. And it would allow exemptions for businesses with fewer than 15 employees. But I mean, it's definitely a little bit more complicated than that. That's like a top level overview.
Right. It seems like there's a lot of math going on there. Opponents in the business community say that, because of that difficult bookkeeping and the math, that this would place a major burden on employers as they're trying to keep track of who's earning, you know, certain salaries and what the percentage is and who pays and all of that. Is that kind of their major opposition? Is it bureaucratic, or is there some level of agreement in there somewhere that maybe family leave is, you know, could be a workable idea?
Yes, I mean, there is agreement. I think everyone from the sponsors of the legislation, and this bill has a lot of co-sponsors, 101 sponsors on this bill, including one Republican. They all want to see this passed. Business groups say they want to see it passed or see paid family medical leave. And Governor Mills would like to see paid family medical leave. The question is, can they reach a compromise? And so for the business groups, they think it's an administrative burden. The current form, they think it's too generous. It's too expensive. They also think it's going to make the workforce shortage even worse. I mean, the Maine State Chamber said if businesses right now are having a hard time filling positions and someone takes 12 weeks leave under this program, how are they going to find someone to fill in for those 12 weeks? So that's a major concern.
Yeah, there was one, I heard someone say from the business community, well, what happens if I hire someone and then the day they're hired, they take 12 weeks off and they're a summer employee, I lose them for 12 out of the 16 weeks of the summer. So that was an example, I guess, of the worst fears that might materialize.
Right. But, you know, I mean, I think, the sponsors of this bill, so Senator Maddie Daughtry, she's been working on this for more than a decade, and she's introduced several iterations of this. And she really thinks that this is the year that it's going to happen, that it will be passed. I think partly because of the bill she's introduced in the past, she's kind of learned what works, what doesn't. I think also the way that this bill was done, it came out of a committee that was tasked with creating a plan for a paid family and medical leave program. And so she co-chaired that with Representative Kristen Cloutier. They spent 2 years developing recommendations, then sought feedback. They said they spoke to hundreds of businesses and individuals and incorporated that feedback to come up with a bill that really reflected many different viewpoints. So they've really emphasized that they want to keep working on this. And actually at the public hearing yesterday, they presented a compromise to the original bill that they submitted. The question is, you know, can they reach a compromise when there's only 4 weeks left in the legislative session? This is a very complicated issue. There's a lot at stake financially. And something else that they're kind of running up against is there's this voter referendum waiting in the wings. If this is not passed in the legislature, this could be on the ballot in 2024. And a lot of people would rather see a legislative solution that does incorporate many viewpoints versus just a straight ahead voter referendum.
Yeah. And Steve, as Patty's saying, time's kind of running out in this session, and there are a handful of other measures that kind of hang in the balance, including solar incentives.
Yeah, that's one big issue hanging out there. And right now, the debate over what's called net energy billing is really heating up. So net energy billing is basically a subsidy program that was bolstered in 2019 to really supercharge solar development. And it's worked in terms of facilitating projects That's why we're seeing them pop up all over the state. There's even one in the Jug Handle off of I-95 in Augusta. The issue with these, though, is that they're subsidized in part by electricity ratepayers, and the bill is coming due, and at a time when rates are already quite high. So Bill Harwood, the public advocate, has been calling for some reforms to dial back this program, and that's drawn the ire of the solar industry, which has accused him of carrying the water of Central Maine Power and Versant Power, two companies that are arguably reluctant participants in the program. I'm not sure how this will all shake out, Keith. I do know, though, that the governor isn't quite ready to dial back the program, at least not to the extent that the public advocate would like. But there's no doubt that ratepayers will feel a pinch if the legislature doesn't make some changes before the end of the session. There's also several other issues that are being discussed, but will likely have to wait until next year, including an anticipated tribal sovereignty bill and either an expansion or a repeal of Maine's landmark internet privacy law.
So those are likely to go into the next session.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, internet privacy for sure, tribal sovereignty for sure, and the solar issue might actually get resolved before the end of this year.
This week, sadly, we lost our friend and colleague, Mal Leary, who died last weekend. He was 72 and is being remembered today in Augusta. And of course, he was a prominent voice, not only in this very segment on this program, but he was our Statehouse bureau chief for decades and our go-to on election night and for radio and TV and political debates. And of course, you know, Mal's known in journalism circles as a relentless advocate for openness in government. This was near and dear to his heart, not just in Maine, but he became president of the National Freedom of Information Coalition. It's quite a career in his 45 years, Steve.
Yeah, Keith, it's pretty amazing that 45 years of Mal's life were dedicated to this job, and an important part of it is government transparency. And Mal, as you said, was a relentless advocate for that. He played a huge part in crafting and changing Maine's Freedom of Access Act, which is the state version of the federal Freedom of Information Act, which basically allows the public to examine and observe the actions of its government and public officials. And Mal really held public officials accountable to Maine's law. I remember in 2012 when Republican Governor Paula Page tried to pass a bill that shielded a lot of his working papers from the Maine open records law. And Mal fought that as an advocate for open government and even used an interview he did with LePage as a candidate for leverage. During that interview, candidate LePage had told Mal, quote, "If I'm elected governor, we're going to be so open, even you will be amazed." But of course, that changed once he became governor, and Mal reminded him of it, telling the Bangor Daily News in 2012, quote, "I'm amazed, but not in the way the governor thought I would be." And of course, a lot of people will remember Mal for his career in open government and advocacy, and of course I will too. But as someone who worked with him for 5 years, I'll remember a lot of other little things that were sort of peeks into his personality. You know, he loved cats, which always made sense to me because Mal was such a fastidious person and reserved in the sharing of his personal life. But he could also be very incredibly warm and sentimental if he trusted you. He had high expectations for people, but often higher ones for himself. Reporters who heard the stream of profanities from his office when he messed up recording his voice tracks can confirm this. You know, it was a pretty jarring experience for first-time visitors to the Statehouse Press Corps, especially when that blue language was coming from the offices of Maine Public Radio. He was always entertained by legislators' attempts at humor during debates, which I never understood, but I loved anyway because he seemed genuinely amused, you know? And you can relate to this, Keith, as his former supervisor. And when someone asked him how he was doing, he would often respond by saying, "functioning," and that would be that.
Yeah, that would be that. There's also an interesting story about there was a time there was a legislative aide who was trying to control a press conference that you mentioned.
Yeah, that's right. You know, this aide, you know, was doing what a lot of press aides do, which is, you know, a routine tactic that's designed to shield the politician from a press conference that press conference that goes on too long, their talking points are exhausted, and they have to, you know, think on their feet and maybe be a little candid. And at this press conference, this aide calls out one more question, and Mao shoots back, "We'll ask as many questions as we want. This is a press conference, and it'll be over when we're done." And it was.
That was Mao. Patty, you worked with Mao, of course. So how will you remember him?
His deep institutional knowledge. You know, whenever I went to the State House when he was working there, I often had questions because it's a complicated place. And whether I was asking about something happening that day or a larger question about how the legislature functions, he always had interesting insights, and his depth of knowledge just reflected his dedication as a political reporter.
Yeah. Steve, you wrote in this week's Pulse newsletter that your son had created his own image of Mao, as you know, we often do based on stories that, you know, you share after coming home from work at the State House. But then you both listened to our radio piece on Mao's career and his accomplishments while you were driving to school together on Monday morning. And you could see that your son realized that there was something more to the image that he had in his mind.
Yeah, Keith, I think for my son, the tribute to Mao was a reminder that he was much more than this collection of funny stories that I tell him. And of course, Mao's career had long defined him for a lot of people in a different way. And I think he really understood this. And maybe that's why he worked longer and harder than he needed to. You know, he could have retired a lot earlier than he did. And the fact that he didn't, I think, speaks to his sense of duty to this job, this profession. And I think a lot of people remember him for that. And I think my son is one of them.
Yeah, right. Thanks to both of you. Steve Missler, our political chief political correspondent, and Patty White covers healthcare for Maine Public. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we turn our attention to other news from around the state with our editorial page editors. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, The Month in Review. My guests now are Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, Siobhan Brett, opinion editor of the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram, and Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Share your comments and questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org, comment on our Facebook page or on Twitter or Instagram, or you can give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. We'll start with this, with the issue of abortion. In the aftermath of the Roe v. Wade overturn, you know, hundreds of people came to the State House to testify on a slate of bills this month that would protect and expand access to abortion. And one of the most closely watched bills, as we discussed earlier, was sponsored by Governor Janet Mills, that would lift the ban on abortions later in pregnancy and let physicians and patients play a larger role in determination. Opponents say they're considering the people's veto if they can't stop this in the legislature. I guess, Siobhan, it's important to see this in the context of being part of a wave of responses by state legislatures from all over the country in all various directions in recent months.
Yes, I think that's just right. We wrote, it's a number of months back now, about Governor Mills actually sort of signing on to a coalition of other state governors who kind of pledged to work together and trade notes, as it were, on this new reality, figuring out exactly how best to legislatively respond to the post-Roe landscape. It shouldn't really have come as a surprise, I guess, to any of us that the public would be as invested in this as they are. The hearing in Augusta was attended, as you said, by hundreds. I think it ran 19 or 20 hours duration. We have received an abundance of letters from both sides of the argument. It's an incredibly emotional one in most cases. And a lot of the language that's used you know, we've seen this time and again when it comes to the abortion debate. It's pretty inflammatory. And I think, you know, and I know we've spoken about this on this program too, the change or the move to make this change by Governor Mills has been seen by some as going back on her word when campaigning. Didn't appear as though there was much of an expansion in the pipeline. And we see now, obviously, that moving its way through the State House. So as regards where we are, perhaps I'll defer to my editorial okay. editor colleagues on the very latest, but we're watching it closely and I guess seeing a lot of it maybe play out kind of as expected, pro and, and con arguments.
Yeah. Ben Bragdon, what's been the response from where you sit?
Well, like both you and Siobhan said, and the previous guest said, you know, the decision cutting down Roe v. Wade really set off a lot of passion and energy on both sides. And this is kind of like the first chance that is really coming forward in the form of legislation in Maine. And, you know, the hearing, I think, really showed how much the anti-abortion side of things is energized right now by this, how extreme they see it to be, even if they don't, as Siobhan said, they've used a lot of inflammatory language. They see this as not only a bad policy, but evil. And one thing I will say, I think that the number of anti-abortion people that spoke at this rally, I think the group of them, and judging from the letters we've got, not only the number of the letters, but the tone of the letters, is that they really feel that they are on not only on the right side of this issue, but that on the right side of Maine public opinion, and that maybe all of this coming out, them talking about how extreme this bill is really striking. They feel it's really striking a chord. Now, everything else we know about abortion rights in Maine says otherwise. That the vast majority of people support it the way it is, even support this law. They listen to the stories about why a law like this is necessary in a small number of cases and see it as fairly reasonable. But the people on the other side don't see it that way. And I really think they may have talked themselves into thinking they have the upper hand on this issue, maybe not in the legislature. I mean, they might be able to move one or two people and stop this bill, but I think it's unlikely. But I just can't see a referendum on this issue doing anything but just dividing people more and then not getting the outcome that they wish. So I don't think after all said and done, I think this bill is going to pass, maybe its legacy is going to be that it kind of ratcheted up the abortion rights discussion in the state and left a lot of people disappointed.
Yeah. Susan Young, of course, these laws, as when they pass, they're only in place until maybe the next governor or the next legislature decides whether they should be or not. Do you foresee maybe in the wake of the demise of Roe v. Wade that we could see abortion limit bills or, you know, moving in either direction every 4 years here going forward?
Yeah, I think that's certainly one of the dangers and one of the things that Senator Susan Collins has talked about as well with her legislation that is going nowhere in Congress, but an effort to try and bring some certainty, which with the court's action became a lot of uncertainty around reproductive rights. But you're right, Keith, if we leave this to politics, in Maine, I think it's very different than in states in the South, but we could have a situation where the law changes depending on who's in the Blaine House and what party controls the legislature. And I think that's what this bill is a small part of trying to avoid those kind of outcomes, to say, here's what the states law is, here's what our policy is, and, you know, bring some certainty, which of course you can't, because elections can change that outcome. But that's a frustration of a lot of people who support reproductive rights, is that because this has become so political, there is no certainty, and women and families don't know what kind of decisions they will be allowed to make. Physicians have to worry whether they will be punished, even prosecuted, for providing care that they believe is necessary. So it's a very unfortunate situation that we can't be in a place where there's a lot more certainty about people's health and their health care.
There's another national trend here, which is censorship in school libraries. The American Civil Liberties Union of Maine and legal advocacy group GLAAD are urging Maine schools to stand up against calls to ban certain books. The two organizations sent a letter to Maine school administrators this month that provides the legal framework to resist the push from some community members and lawmakers to censor books. And the ACLU of Maine's legal director, Carol Garvin, says that often the books targeted are about LGBTQ people and people of color. Is this an issue that we can expect to heat up as we get close to the presidential election, Siobhan?
Yeah, without a doubt, Keith. I think it's already hot, unfortunately, and our editorial board has spent time speaking with educators and librarians who've been kind of batting off and fighting these advances for a long time. And you'll see it done in different ways, in ways that are sort of soft, you know, parent by parent, maybe classroom by classroom. You'll see it done via freedom of information request. You'll see pressure being exerted on schools regarding the content that they use and the material that they use, as well as books. And in many cases, the targets are books that may just have an offending word in the title, or in some national reporting, we've seen it borne out that the books in question haven't even really been read. Never mind cover to cover, but at all, by the parents that are seeking to have them cast away. And I mean, I personally find it very sort of bemusing as a flashpoint. We are in a time of rampantly available technology. Kids are more connected than they've ever been and have more access to content of all stripes and all varieties at home and probably at school. And instead we see shortlists, these sort of buzzy shortlists of books that are apparently corrupting and destroying, our children's abilities to see straight. When in reality, those who are advocating for these books to stay and fighting against the very concept of a book ban, which is kind of unbelievable to be discussing in 2023, are saying, no, these serve a really important purpose to the children who need to seek them out. A lot of the time they handle issues that a child may not be able to get information or context on elsewhere. Kids that are a little bit more vulnerable, looking for answers, don't have them at home, can turn to books as they have for decades and centuries. So hopefully that will last, but my God, it's a really dispiriting waste of time and resources for it to be fought the way it's being fought. And Maine is obviously not immune to it.
Yeah. Ben Bragdon?
Yeah, I think the Siobhan's last point, I wanted to expand a little bit more, the waste of time and resources. I mean, we've got school boards, local school boards, full of volunteer school board members trying to guide their school districts after a incredibly, upsetting, chaotic time during the pandemic, and they've got learning loss, and they've got kid mental health issues to deal with. School districts around Maine are having trouble dealing with inflation and making sure that they have all the resources to educate their kids at this time. And then they're having to deal with, what is really a national effort to rile people up and get them to attack school boards. Everybody, there's a wide range of thought on these things, and parents can have different ideas about what their parents, what their kids should be reading, and what should be available in school. But there's a process for working through that, that doesn't include, you know, going to school board meetings and screaming nonsense at the school board members, and taking up their time and, you know, trying to act as if you're on, you know, Fox News or something. And it's really disrupting, I think, all the school boards. I mean, besides all the problems with pulling books and all the issues there, it's just really disrupting to what school boards are trying to do right now. And it seems like, you know, it's all for the purpose of disrupting public schools and trying to cast doubt on public schools. It's too bad that some people fall for it and then bring that fight to their local schools, but that's what's happening. And it's just up to everybody else to, make sure you're arguing on the right side of things here and arguing in the right way, trying to figure out these thorny issues in the right way, not by screaming at people, and to support school board members who are trying to do the right thing.
Susan Young, how is this playing out with your readers? Do you have a sense?
Just two quick points to build on what Ben and Siobhan said. I think it's becoming increasingly clear that these efforts are led or even being done by just a very small group of people, as the Washington Post did an analysis. Their conclusion was 11 people nationally are responsible for a huge number of these requests. So it's very distressing that they're not reflective of what most parents and community members think. And I want to amplify Siobhan's point that, you know, it's a campaign of marginalization and to, in some cases, erase people, you know, who are different. Some of these books are about people of color. A lot of them are about the LGBTQ community. And it's an effort to make sure that some kids don't know that these people exist, don't know the history of our country, some of which was quite ugly. And it's just really dangerous. We're seeing this, you know, as these groups feel empowered, and now, you know, they're literally going into Target stores and ripping down displays and stomping on them. I mean, we can't allow groups that want to erase certain groups of Americans from our landscape and from our fabric. And so I really sympathize with school board members and teachers and others who have to address these concerns, but it's really important for the rest of us to also stand up to this small group that's trying to rewrite what America is and what our history is.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, it's time to revisit some of the top stories from around the state this month. My guests are three editorial page editors, Siobhan Brett with the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, and Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Bar Harbor. And Anne. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the program. I know you've been waiting patiently.
Hi. Thank you very much. So relating to anti-abortion, relating to book bans, many of those initiatives are funded by groups aligned with our neighbor Leonard Leo here on Mount Desert Island. And when I protested that, the police defended my protest as legal, but a local official was more compliant to Leonard Leo and mounted a campaign in the press of lies about me. And when I tried to get these false statements corrected, I was brushed off. And the MPA has, you know, very nice spotlight on ethics, but no procedures. And this sort of problem, you know, in small communities like MDI and with digital editions, this can be a problem for residents who engage in civic life. So I wondered if you can enlighten me as to what the actual review process may be when you bring empirical evidence and say this is a false statement and it's on the internet forever. People are contacting me saying, oh, you know, what did you do? And I'm like, I didn't do that.
Ben, you want to start?
Getting involved in politics and especially local politics and, you know, maybe you don't even see it as getting involved in politics. You just see it as you know, getting involved in something that you care about. But it's in the political realm and especially local politics can get very heated. And now there's a lot of ways for people to speak their mind without much, oversight to that. I don't know if the things you're talking about were printed in a newspaper or on social media or things like that. I mean, we try when we're kind of playing referee in these community discussions to make sure people follow the rules as much as possible and that they treat each other with respect, and that anything that is put forward as a fact has been vetted, and something that is opinion is rightfully portrayed as opinion and is not, you know, disparaging anyone. But that's tough. It's tough. I don't know Anne's specific situation here, things can get very nasty in the local realm, and it's hard, becoming increasingly hard for people, I think, to step forward and speak their mind publicly because, you know, that can go bad in so many ways.
Yeah. And Shivana, in this era now, if it's beyond a local issue, if you say something that rubs somebody the wrong way in a national group, you can become barraged on the internet.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Again, we don't, it's the nature of a call-in radio show that we don't have too many specifics.
We can't comment on the specifics of this case, right?
But that's all right. I think it's enough maybe to say, to sort of piggyback off what Ben just said, which is, yeah, there are certain still, thankfully, and, you know, we're trying to uphold them. There are certain publications that have what I would call production values and work at keeping things correct and ensuring that things that they publish are don't veer into personal attack and so on. But the internet itself is complete Wild West and getting worse by the day. And if it's any comfort to Anne, which I'm sure it's cold comfort, I think the majority of news and media consumers, maybe not the majority, but I think an increasing number of news and media consumers are aware of that and don't take everything they see on face value or at face value. And so while there is sometimes a kind of terrifying feeling of something gaining traction and snowballing as you look at it online and you are trying to gauge how far it's traveled or how many people have liked it or decided to repost it or whatever, a lot of it is noise. Very little of it is verified. And as a result, I think people discount much more than they take on. At least that's my hope. And maybe I'm daft and a chronic optimist who should be ignored. But I guess that's where I'd land on that.
Yeah. I want to get to the asylum seeker story. Dozens of asylum seekers arriving in Sanford earlier this month, hoping to find shelter. Many of them said they had been turned away from shelters in Portland. They're part of more than reported 1,000 asylum seekers who've come to Maine since the first of the year. And the situation has really exhausted the emergency housing system in southern Maine. Shelters are full. The city of Portland in particular. And I guess my question, Susan, will go to you first. Is this really a problem for local governments to tackle? People showing up from other parts and seeking services in a city the size of Portland, or does the state have a role, or as the city has requested, do private nonprofits, charities, should they share in this effort?
Well, unfortunately, as you say, it has become a problem for individual cities, particularly Portland, Lewiston, South Portland. Of course, there should be a statewide response. I mean, it's only natural that folks new to America and new to Maine want to be in communities where they may already know people, or there may be people, from their home countries who speak their language, know their culture. But it's increasingly clear that we need a statewide response. Not suggesting that new Mainers be moved to parts of the state against their will where they don't want to live, but we have shortages of workers across the state. And so encouraging, helping these folks perhaps spread out to other parts of the state would be helpful. We also need support and changes in law at the federal level as well. We've talked about before the long delay in new arrivals being allowed to work. Our delegation is supporting and working on legislation to change that. It's at least 6 months in practice, often a year or more before these folks can work. They want to work, but when they're unable to work, that does mean that local communities and nonprofits are supporting where they live, something as simple as making sure they have food and clothing and what they need for their children. So yeah, everybody needs to participate, and we need much more coherent, thoughtful, and forward-looking policies to welcome these people and ensure that they're living in the right place with the supports they need for as long as they need them, but also helping them to be self-sufficient much more quickly.
Siobhan, only a few minutes left. Just wanted to warn you.
All right, thanks. I do it very often. I'm in the lucky position of being able to just echo what Susan said regarding state coordination and just something a little bit more focused. And I'll add that the Press Herald has put out a particularly spectacular reporting series this week called Long Way Home, which really drills kind of through into the personal stories and experiences of asylum seekers, going beyond the kind of abstract discourse that we've all been trading in for the last few weeks and months. I really recommend giving it a read.
Yeah, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, this everything with Sanford and that's happening in Portland really just highlights how crazy this whole approach to asylum seekers is. I mean, we know that when they get to the border, they come across the border and they're sort of registered as asylum seekers. They're kind of released into the country where as the process plays out, and they don't know anyone. They don't know the language a lot of times. They, as Susan said, they can't work for a while, and yet there's no plan for dealing with them, which is how they end up in a place like Portland. And then that starts to kind of look like a plan until it gets overwhelmed. And then they end up in a place like Sanford, not because of any official plan for handling them, but just because they're just trying to figure out, where are they going to stay? Where are they going to get food? Where are they going to get settled? And it's not good for anybody. It doesn't work for the communities. It doesn't work for the immigrants. It doesn't work for taxpayers. And so it's really up to the elected officials to figure this out, hopefully at the federal level, hopefully at the state level, because the local communities seem like they're just maxed out at this point.
Yeah, and what, just follow up on the state, what more could the state do, do you think? Is the state doing enough, to either Susan?
Well, I'm sorry, but I think you know there could be some sort of statewide system. I think the advocates have asked for some sort of office, you know, in the governor's office and the state level that could coordinate these things, that could act as like the clearinghouse for information and for resources, and take some of it off the shoulders of the local communities. I think that would help a lot.
Yeah, just on the clearinghouse idea, it would just be helpful for communities to know who's coming and when, and, you know, even more thorough, what kind of skills do people have? I mean, it's just ridiculous, as Ben said, how hodgepodge this system is. I mean, any kind of coordination, I think, would be an improvement.
Right. And with that, we thank you. We're out of time. Appreciate your comments here today, as always. Siobhan Brett is opinion editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Susan Young, editorial page editor with the Bangor Daily News. And Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Today's sound engineer was K.G. Akinmaladun. Our theme music was created by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. You can visit mainecalling.org to subscribe to Maine Calling's weekly newsletter and to find the archive of our past shows. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.